Flimby, Fewdy, Fairdy. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, where on the date of Robertson presiding, is not open to the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good afternoon. This is the time and the place set for the February rules hearing, which the court annually holds. Justice Conan Camp had planned on attending today and called at 10 o'clock this morning and said that the interstate was closed between Wall and Rapid City, which only lends credence to our suspicions that his claim that the weather was always good in Rapid City is not always correct. He is now advised he is en route, but obviously will not get here till later in the day. But we will make a recording of this available to him, and will not conference on these proposed changes until such time as he's arrived. And so, and I see Mr. Leach is here.
That's true, Your Honor.
Did you come through this morning, sir?
I did. I must have left a little earlier than Justice Conan.
I see. All right. Okay. Very well. Well, we'll just proceed then in the order in which they were advertised by the state law and the notice ruled, and just if you wish to speak to a specific rule, come forward at that time. Rule number one is the proposed amendment to SDCL 1524-8, and this would be a rule proposed by the media coordinator in regards to our cameras in the courtroom. Does anybody wish to speak on behalf of this rule? Does anybody wish to speak against it? If not, we'll proceed to proposed number two. This would be an amendment to SDCL 1526A60. This is a dealing with briefs on appeal. Does anybody wish to be heard in favor of this? Against? If not, number three. Proposal is an amendment to SDCL 1526A61. Again, with a subject of briefs, does anybody wish to be heard on behalf of this? Does anybody wish to be heard against it? If not, we'll proceed to proposal number four, the proposed amendment of SDCL 16.3.5.1, dealing with the notice for proposed rule changes before this court by electronic method rather than exclusively printed method. Does anybody wish to speak against this rule? Mr. Barnett, you'll be here on behalf of the state bar. Do you wish to state anything in behalf of it?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Proposed rule number five would amend SDCL 1616.2.4. And this is the proposal would expand the use of information. And this will include then the applicant's criminal background check proposed by the Attorney General's office. Or anybody wish to be heard on behalf of this?
Your Honor, there are a total of six proposed changes which either come from the bar examiners or which come from the bar examiners at another agency like the AG's office. At some point in your process, if the court deems it appropriate, I think it might work for me to just explain each of these.
First off, I misspoke. This wasn't an Attorney General's proposal. It's bar examiners. It's why Mr. Eichstedt probably got a little excited when I know. Mr. Leach, why don't you come forward at this time and address all six? If you would come to the podium, please.
Good afternoon. Let me simply start with number five, the one we're on, and I'll go down through each of the six one by one and tell you why they are there, where they come from, what they're trying to accomplish. Number five was added at the suggestion of the Attorney General's office. As you know, there is a fingerprinting bill which has been passed by both houses of the legislature, which will allow us now for the first time to have applicants for admission to the bar in South Dakota fingerprinted, and then have us send those fingerprints to the DCI and the FBI. course, applicants have always had to tell us their criminal background, if any. This change simply allows us to find out whether they're telling us the truth or not. And the specific change that is included in proposal number five was suggested by the Attorney General's office so that the Department of Justice would be satisfied overall with the rule we submitted, which we had to pre-clear. So it's simply for that purpose that change number five is there. The next bar examiner matter is proposal number six, which deals with both adding the applicable fee for the National Conference of Bar Examiners character report and eliminating the fee for a late application to take the bar. And there are two separate things going on there. First of all, NCBE has for a number of years offered an automated standardized character investigation. The form that a person has to fill out for that process is quite lengthy and extensive. And after looking at this for a number of years, we decided that it would be more effective to have NCBE do its investigative process through its office with all the automation it has and its expertise, then for our office here in Ms. Anderson's office to try to be the initiator of these investigations. So the center of the investigation will now move to NCBE, although all choices about what we do with the result of that investigation, of course, remain here. The elimination of the late fee simply relates to the fact that we are not going to have a late application deadline anymore. We're going to have one application deadline. And the reason for that is because we're using the NCBE process, we really don't have time to let people send it in late. They're just going to have to send it in on time so NCBE can deal with it. Now, moving along to number seven, which is the proposed amendment to 16-16-15. The difference proposed is that now when we receive a confidential report, we will be allowed to share it with the applicant for admission. This problem came up specifically this fall when we received some unfavorable information from a third party in a with regard to a bar applicant. And we needed to be able to share that information with the applicant so that we could get his response to it. And under the rule as it exists now, the report is something we cannot share with the applicant. That raises obvious due process problems. Of course, we don't want to be refusing anyone admission on the basis of something they don't have a chance to respond to.
Well, the party then who is submitting the report or recommendation be told up front it will not remain confidential?
That's right. They would be advised that it goes to the applicant also.
Okay. Thank you.
And simply, that's this proposed change is designed to deal with that problem. The next proposed change, which is number eight, changed the time for an aggrieved applicant to seek review from 6 months to 30 days. This is something that came to our attention this spring when an applicant was aggrieved by our decision, and we simply wanted to keep the process moving as opposed to have a maximum of 6 months for that person to object to what we had decided. The fourth proposed change is your number nine, which has several matters in it. Number nine eliminates the late filing period, which I previously mentioned. It imposes the NCB character report requirement, which I previously mentioned. It creates a process if an applicant wants to transfer his or her MBE score to another jurisdiction. And that's done through NCBE. And then it creates a law student first year registration option, which is totally optional for a first year law student, in which they can fill out the NCBE report, send it to NCBE, have NCBE review it, and then we review it in order to identify character and fitness issues that may preclude or hinder later admission.
Would this be so that they don't waste 3 years going to law school if they've got a felony or something that's going to preclude their admission anyway? Is that the idea?
That's part of the idea. There are a couple other things going on. Every so often we hear from the dean that there's a law student who's highly anxious about something in his or her past. It may be something we consider relatively minor, but it allows that kind of applicant to go through this process and hear from us either this really isn't a problem, you can stop worrying, or if it's something like recent problems with a substance, it would be more likely that person would hear from us, we would be much happier 2 years from now if you deal with this problem now, and if you can show us something 2 years from now. So it lets us get involved earlier. Then the final proposed change is item 12 on your list, review by Supreme Court of Bar Examiner's decision on ABA requests. We discussed this briefly at the conference in Chamberlain in September, and essentially the current 16-16-16 allows you to review our decisions as to an applicant's qualifications. We have a separate process for people to request accommodations under the ADA, and we get several of these usually every year. If a person should be aggrieved by our decision under the ADA on their application for accommodations and taking the bar exam, this proposal will mean that review occurs here because it creates the authority for review and the process for review instead of allowing the applicant to seek review in a federal district court. And it just seems more appropriate that review of such a matter be here as opposed to in federal district court.
I have a question in relation to that. It says the court shall thereupon conduct such investigation as it deems necessary to a decision as to the ADA request. When you're setting us up to be an investigator when we're not, and we have little staff to do investigative work, you know.
Sure.
So you really intend to do that?
I'll tell you where that language came from. That language came exactly from the current 16-16-16. Which is reviewed by the Supreme Court of Bar Examiner's decision as to qualifications of applicant. If the court wanted to take it out of both rules, that's certainly fine with us in the court's decision. But actually, I drafted this proposed rule simply tracking exactly the language of 16-16-16.
Any further questions for Mr. Leach from the bench? Okay, that's all the rules you wanted to talk about?
That's it.
Well, thank you for coming in, coming through this fall weather, and have a safe trip home.
Sure. Thank you,
Mr. Leach. All right. Then the next one we would have up would be proposal number 10. This was offered by the State Bar, which would amend the time requirement for filing a resolution with the Secretary Treasurer prior to the annual meeting. Does anybody wish to speak against it? Being no objection, Mr. Barnett, do you have anything to add?
No, Chief Justice.
Okay, thank you.
I have a question for you, Mr. Barnett. It says, it appears a little bit confusing. It first of all says that no resolution or whatever shall be considered by the State Bar, and then it says resolution shall be submitted in writing. Is what you're really saying is instead of shall be considered, no resolution shall be considered by the State Bar, do you mean read or verbally presented?
Justice Sabres, I think the easiest way for me to answer that would be to reiterate what was given to me by my predecessor, Mr. Saar. He used to characterize the first sentence of Section 27 as what differentiates us from the Medical Association, which gives out plaques to everybody that shows up at their annual meeting. And the first sentence is strictly related to complementary resolutions endorsing this particular lawyer for something they did in the previous year and so forth. And you may recall in all the years that we've been attending the annual meetings, and for me it's like 27 of them, we don't do that. The law school is permitted to show up and make its McCusick Award, but it's not the state bar itself. So the first sentence strictly relates to complimentary resolutions honoring a particular individual. However, we do have resolutions that can be substantive in nature. Generally, there's two or three every year. And the current rule allows that a resolution to be submitted to the Resolutions Committee by noon on Friday, which means it's very, very difficult for the membership perhaps to have access to and know what's going to be considered at the business meeting on Saturday. So the policy decision that's suggested in this proposed rule change is that they submit it by May 1st, so that when the annual meeting program goes out in the mail around June 1st, every single active member of the bar is going to have that annual meeting program and will have the resolution contained, and they can make a conscious decision on whether or not they are interested enough that they would show up for the business meeting where that will be taken up. And it also requires that I post that in prominent places around the annual meeting. But the two are not connected, Your Honor.
Would it help if you said no resolution shall be made or considered by the state bar, and then say something like, instead, resolutions shall be submitted in writing and so forth?
I don't know, Your Honor, it's one of those things where I'm bound to present the resolution as passed at the annual meeting.
All right, then let me ask you this. Does the way I say it, do you object to that?
Would you repeat it for me, please?
All right, if I said, just jumping from no resolution shall be insert made or considered by the state bar, shall be made to, I guess, to or considered by the state bar, and then say, instead, resolution shall be submitted in writing.
Perhaps it's an exercise of what I'm used to one floor up this time of the year. I'm not sure where you're suggesting your language, if you could identify.
All right, the third line.
Okay.
The third line, the first word is delivered, comma, shall be, and then I would insert made to or considered by the state bar.
I have no problem with that language, Your Honor.
Right. And then the beginning of the next sentence say, instead, resolution shall be submitted in writing. Just to give it something of a transition there.
And then you would just go on with the balances the way he's
directed
it.
My only quarrel with the instead is that tends to tie resolutions back to those which are prohibited, which are complementary.
Well, isn't it a different way of doing them? I mean, first of all, if you say no resolution, it implies that there's not going to be any resolutions. And then you go on and say, resolution shall be submitted. So I think there is a correlation.
Yeah, isn't your intention, though, that there are no resolutions complementary to any particular person?
How about resolutions other...
Why don't you say other resolutions?
I'm sorry?
Why don't you say other resolutions?
Sure, that'd work.
In the new language.
Sure, that'd be fine. That'd be a lot more simple than what I was just going to suggest.
Okay. All right. So if we did change it to that way, you'd have no objection.
Correct. Your first on line three, made to or considered, I think is probably clarifying language, and other is transitional without tying the two. So I think those are both fine.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, I don't have all the rules with me today, and I've forgotten. Can resolutions be submitted from the floor?
Under the without any change in our bylaws, they can be submitted to the Resolutions Committee by noon on Friday. And the Resolutions Committee consists of the past immediate three presidents of the bar. They meet sometime Friday afternoon, and then they report back on Saturday morning with a recommendation, and then there's action. The only requirement is that, one, it be in writing, and two, that they get it to the president or the chair of the Resolutions Committee, which is the immediate past president. In one sense, this will formalize the process and make sure that everybody gets advance notice of what might be considered. It's particularly relevant this time of the year because oftentimes resolutions being offered are directly related to legislation that's being proposed that has not gone through the committee process, or perhaps came through the committee process and would have been what I would characterize as a minority report, but they were unable to get the majority of that particular committee to go along with it. So then the proposal wouldn't be contained in the annual meeting committee report, which we act on and which authorizes the legislation. So the resolution process has been primarily used by minority views, and they always invariably come up on a Saturday when, as we know, oftentimes, unless there's a presidential contest, we may be down to 60 or 70 active members of the bar present, unless they got wind of it. And so that's how it's been used in the past.
But that bylaw is still going to be in there, so we still could make a resolution at the annual meeting.
No. A resolution would have to be submitted by noon, I mean, probably by May 1st, to my office in order to make the agenda.
Isn't there a repealer necessary for the other bylaw then?
No, because that part of the Friday noon is a bar commission policy that's been around for 30 plus years. I could get you the date on when the bar commissioners adopted the policy, but it was long before I've been around.
So it's not a bylaw.
It's not a bylaw change. This is an addition. That's why there's no repealer.
Mr. Barnett, remember, when was that? 2 years ago, when the whole issue of judicial evaluations was a concern.
About 4 years ago, I think.
No, I think it was the subsequent year, though, after the initial one. But at some point in time, there was an agreement reached during the bar convention among the parties in interest on that. And there was a resolution by Tom Fritz presented during the bar convention, I think, to take some kind of action or not take some kind of action. And I think that was by form of a resolution. That would prevent those kinds of things from happening, or is there another vehicle so those kinds of items can still come before the body?
The way the minutes of that particular business meeting reflect, it was a motion, not a resolution.
Okay.
And if somebody had challenged the based on the noon Friday, the chair was prepared to rule that the Hageman Committee report had never been tabled and had been pending there and continued for those years. So in one sense, for the past 4 years, that proposal with regard to judicial evaluations is still pending, but there's never been any action on it because of the technical motion from past President Fritz acknowledging the voluntary efforts and very good efforts, I might add, that the circuit bench has taken.
So that wouldn't change the ability to...
This would not interfere okay. with motions on topics that are appropriately before the membership. While I'm no parliamentarian, my advice to the chair is that if that topic, subject of the motion, is before the membership, then it's appropriate for action. If that topic is not, then it is unrelated, and then they have to go by resolution and meet the May 1st deadline.
Okay.
one question. You only use the word complementary. Does that imply that someone could make a resolution of a motion uncomplimentary?
I'm not sure.
Maybe Justice Zinner's word of other resolutions shall be submitted might include that. So that's got to be in writing and can't be right on the floor.
Okay. Any further questions from the bench from Mr. Barnett?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett. All right. Next one would be then, let's see, proposal number 11, which would change the expanded media coverage from a pilot project to a permanent rule of the court. Anybody wish to speak on behalf of this? Anybody wish to speak against it? If not, we've already done number 12. Number 13 would be a proposed rule to give parties access to pre-sentence reports for appeal purposes and post-conviction review. This is submitted by the Attorney General's office. Mr. Eichstead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I guess this week was a relatively minor matter, but at the same time, it's something that's occupied our time and that of the court, maybe not this court, but the circuit courts for some time. And really, what we wanted to do by proposing this rule is make access to pre-sentence investigations a fairly uniform thing across the state, and also at the same time for the court and counsel from both sides. But admittedly, it's something that our office is concerned with because we do need access to pre-sentence investigations from time to time. The purpose of the rule is to give counsel automatic access. It doesn't really have any other purpose. So we're not changing the fact that defense counsel and trial prosecutor only have access prior to the time of the sentencing. We're not really intending to change the fact that counsel do, as a practical matter, get access to the pre-sentence investigation during the appeal, because we're not here to complain to the court that we haven't eventually gotten access, but there have been some proceedings we feel that really weren't necessary and that waste the time of both counsel and the court in order to gain access to the pre-sentence investigations. And so that's why we made this proposal. We're really not intending to broaden anything over actual practice. We're just intending to make it easier both for the trial court and for counsel on appeal. I did note that there were some comments by Judge Johnson from the Fourth Judicial Circuit that I could briefly address if the court's interested in hearing that. And in addressing those, there are several of them that we don't really disagree with, and we would consent to a couple of amendments to our proposal if the court wants to go that route. First of all, Judge Johnson talks about full and complete access as perhaps compromising the confidential recommendation that the court services officer may have made to the judge, and that's usually just as you're probably aware. It's just a single sheet that's separate from the remainder of the pre-sentence investigation and goes in the envelope. As a practical matter, we have, perhaps inadvertently, gained access to those things a number of times over the years. They're in the envelope. The judge has given us permission to break the seal and open the envelope. There it is, we see it. But as far as being at all useful for counsel's use on appeal or in a post-conviction proceeding, it really isn't. So we don't have any problem if the court wishes to exclude those recommendations because we haven't used them for anything in the past, and if we've inadvertently gained access to them, I don't really think any harm has been done. But on the other hand, if that's a concern of the court, certainly they could be removed, or we could just add a sentence that would allow those to be taken out. Copying the report. We don't intend by this rule to begin any process of copying pre-sentence investigations. We've mostly avoided that in the past. There may be one or two occasions where our office has made a copy with the permission of the court to be given to defense counsel or some other counsel, or for that matter, with the permission of the court, perhaps going to the federal court, the federal habeas matter. But we wouldn't mind having a sentence added to the rule that would prohibit copying except at the explicit permission of the trial court that received the pre-sentence. I don't know if it's necessary because that hasn't been an issue in the past, but certainly we wouldn't mind having that. Access by pro se parties. I don't really know the implications of that from the standpoint of a defense if someone happened to be pro se. We were really only thinking of access by counsel, and in nearly every direct appeal, the defendant will be represented by counsel, and counsel will be able to take a look at the pre-sentence investigation under this rule. But if the court wished to strike the phrase "or an unrepresented party," which is in the fourth line of the proposal, we wouldn't have any problem with that. And in fact, you could even, if you wish, place something in the first sentence of the rule, if I could figure out exactly where it says the parties to the matter shall have full and complete access. We need to consent to having something added. Counsel to the parties shall have, if the court wished to do that, based on what Judge Johnson has asked here. We really don't believe any more than Judge Johnson does want to have pre-sentence investigations floating around the penitentiary. That would be a bad thing. The couple of final comments Judge Johnson had, I think we respectfully disagree with him on those. The public defender saying that he would tell his clients not to respond to the court services officer if, in fact, this rule were in place. I don't really see where the public defender is coming from on that, but presumably it's to the defendant's benefit to be completely frank with the officer doing the pre-sentence investigation. This rule doesn't change that, and in fact, there's access by the state's attorney to it already, so nothing is being revealed to the state that the state wouldn't already know about.
Would the defendant waive the pre-sentence to begin with?
Some do, yeah. Sometimes. You waive the pre-sentence, John?
Sure, it's routinely done.
Sure, if he doesn't want to talk to the court services officer, he can certainly waive it, but there's really no momentum for a defendant here because he can either talk to the officer or he doesn't talk to him, and of course if he doesn't talk to him, then you may have a problem for the defendant in terms of how the judge views that, and of course the trial judge can always consider the fact that the defendant hasn't shown remorse, hasn't been frank, and so on, and in the course of sentencing. It's not like it would be pre-trial before the defendant's been convicted. So I think if the public defender were to advise his client that way, it might conceivably be bad advice from the public defender, but it really isn't relevant to whether the defendant ought to or ought not talk to the court services officer. But in most instances, we would think it would be to his benefit to do so, depending on how the trial judge was going to look at sentencing. Judge Johnson's final comment was that he believes that the pre-sentence ought to be restricted to being viewed at the clerk's office. I don't think that's been the case. In fact, our office gets the original record ordinarily from the clerk's office, and most of the time the pre-sentence investigation is already part of that record. It's in the envelope in the file. We get it. And really all we're doing by this rule is asking that the Attorney General's office, or for that matter the defense attorney, be able to open that envelope that we've already got and look at it. I don't think it would be reasonable when we need access to the PSI, particularly for arguing propriety of a sentence, if we'd have to hop in a car and drive to every county seat in order to look at it. I don't understand why that would need to be done. And as far as access to it in general is concerned, of course, we need it because oftentimes the sentence is going to be argued, whether it's cruel and unusual or whether it's proper or improper. And so in order to understand why the trial judge sentence the way that he or she did, you need to take a look at the pre-sentence because that's the biggest source of information that the trial judge will have.
Are they all sealed? Is that statutory?
I may have seen one or two in 20 years of doing this, Your Honor, the work, but I'd have to say, in my experience, 99% of them are. They're sealed in an envelope in the file. Now, I think in some counties, maybe in Minnehaha County, we're talking to some others, it may not actually be placed in the file. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we've had to, in a couple of instances, go down and appear in front of the court or have the state's attorney's office appear in front of the court and get the record changed. And that was part of the motivation for this, because in a couple of those cases, defense counsel had objected to putting it in the record, objected to having us see it, and we've never lost one of those motions. On the other hand, we just think it's wasting everybody's time to have to go through those.
If it isn't filed, though, this isn't going to help you, is it?
We still have to get it filed, but presumably, if the automatic access provision is there, I would think that in most instances, defense counsel would just stipulate. And if they stipulate, we don't need to go in front of the court and just add it to the record and stipulate.
How often has this happened, would you say? I mean, how...
I'm aware of twice that it's happened in Minnehaha County that we've actually had to go in front of the court. But in every other instance, we need to get the court's permission by some method or another, unless it's one of those extremely rare ones where it hasn't been sealed. So this would just obviate our having to get permission. And as far as that goes, we attended recently. Sometimes we just called up the trial judge and asked for permission. But I think recently we've tended, in fact, we've had some of his objections from defense counsel, we've tended to go ahead and make a motion, dictate a formal motion, and serve it on defense counsel, and then if they want to object, I guess they can.
I take it while all this is going on, then the appeal's simply dead in the water until it's taken care of, so it delays the entire proceeding.
It could delay the proceeding as well, Your Honor. That's true, and it's varied from county to county, and we just wanted to make things uniform.
How often does this happen where you have to file a motion with the trial judge?
Now, sometimes, if we can call the trial judge up and get a whole permission, that works. But lately, I think we tended to go against that. So it'd be just about every case, and we want to have access to pre-sentence investigation.
How many is that? I'm trying to get an idea.
Okay.
Does this happen once a month, or once a year, or twice a year, or what?
I would think in our office, probably happens every month, once or twice, would be my guess, because we need to seek your permission. And certainly in every one of these cases where there's both a pre-sentence and an issue of cruel and unusual punishment, we'd certainly want to have the pre-sentence and look at the pre-sentence in all those instances. And in a lot of instances, if the defendant, for example, told a different story to the court services officer, then he either testified at trial or told law enforcement or whatever, we want to have access to that as well. So it's really a good precaution for us to attempt to take a look at them in most cases, see if there are other things that would be relevant.
In the third line there, should the words full and complete be omitted? Because what's really important, it appears, it's almost like it's creating a mistake or going too far. Because I think all you need is shall have access to the pre-sentence investigation.
Sure, we wouldn't have any objection to that, Your Honor.
And later on, because later on it spells out the, you know, mm-hmm. that it has to be confidential, either in the briefs or to the court.
Sure. Yeah. Is there any alternative access, expedited access, that you could think of that would work with the trial judge? And the reason I ask the question, there's no question that you need and are entitled to access in the appropriate case. But the trial judge is the one that sealed that document, that record. And while this court can look at anything in the record, you know, permitting any counsel to look at something without the permission of the judge that actually sealed it has some potential for concern. Is there any alternative that comes to mind to you that might provide an expedited method of getting you the access you need, other than just simply allowing you to unseal some judge's sealed document without that judge knowing about it?
If it wasn't a matter of making a motion, and if we could, in every instance, just give the judge a phone call or send him or her an email or something like that, that might be a compromise point. And we've done that in the past sometimes, but given the fact that we've gotten these objections, we've gotten a little uncomfortable doing it ex parte that way. But if the court passed a rule and said something to the effect that access may be gained ex parte or this something of that nature, it would explicitly permit talking to the judge ex parte about this one matter, that might do it, because then it would be just a matter of talking to the judge. You wouldn't have to worry about having perhaps ex parte the judge on something that we don't have an explicit rule allowing that on, because that I think frankly has been our concern. We didn't want to be seen as asking the judge to do something ex parte, particularly where in some instances there have been objections. So that's a possibility.
Any further questions for Mr. Eggsted?
Matt, thank you, counsel. That would then complete the proposed rules. The court will take the comments under advisement and issue its decisions on these proposals in the near future. Court is in recess. Thank you.